You spit in a cup, you send it in, you get your results back on a web page. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? Well, maybe. But what do all the risk factors mean? Are they clinically useful? And is the information I get back really all about me personally, or do these risk factors in my DNA have implications for family members who might not have been excited about sharing their personal info online? Welcome to the Science Progress Wonk Lab podcast, where we talk about the intersection between science and progressive public policy. I'm managing editor Andrew Pratt. And today I'm talking with Sandra Sujin Lee, a senior research scholar at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. And we're talking about the growing industry of direct-to-consumer genetic testing and social networking, and how it blurs the lines between consumer and research participant.
Professor Lee, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
The recent work that you've done focuses on direct-to-consumer genomics and the social networking software, and it's built in with some of these new products. But I just want to sort of back up a moment and ask, give us the big picture. What can people learn about their genomes from this new direct-to-consumer genetic testing that's offered?
Right. Well, at this point, it's rather unclear, actually, what you can learn from some of these direct-to-consumer genetic tests. Much of the research on the genetic basis for complex diseases and traits that we're most interested in is really in its nascency, and that there's very little consensus among scientists in the field right now. Genome-wide association studies, referred to often as GWAS, or GWAS, are based really on the assumption that there are genetic variations that are identified with single base pair differences between individuals. So these base pairs are known as adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, and they're indicated by the letters A, T, G, C. So, for example, where you might have an A, I might have a T in my genomic code. And some of these variations are scrutinized to see if they might have some association with some of the diseases that we're most interested in, for example, coronary heart disease, diabetes, asthma. And right now, the state of the field is such that we haven't found any very strong associations or associations that have been highly replicated. And so that's given many people pause as to whether or not we should be at this point releasing this type of information to the public.
And so the way this works is if I sign up for one of the services that these companies offer, I send them a spit sample and they run my DNA and then compare it to the results of these GWAS studies?
That's right. So it is actually rather simple. You can, anyone who has access to the internet can go to one of these sites and sign up, and you pay anywhere from a couple $100 to a couple $1,000, and you'll receive a kit in the mail. And generally, they ask you for a fairly substantial saliva sample that you put in a little vial, and you send that away. And in most cases, that doesn't go back to the company, but it'll often go to a lab that they are collaborating with, who that will actually do the sequencing for the company. And then the raw data is then given to the company, and the company then interprets the data. So from your genetic code, they may look at specific markers that they believe the literature indicates has an association with a whole host of different diseases and traits, and then they will then give back to the customer via a password-protected internet page information about their susceptibility to these various diseases and traits.
And is that information accurate? I'm not a geneticist, I'm not a scientist. If I'm sending this stuff off, how do I know that the comparisons that they're telling me about are correct?
Well, that is a big concern at this point, because what they base the information on can really range in quality. Right now, again, as I said, there's very few really robust replicated studies in the field, and so oftentimes the associations that they may be suggesting may be actually very weak, and so there isn't really a lot of oversight right now, at least in terms of federal agencies, looking at how valid some of the clinical utility information that they're giving to customers really is.
Well, do we need regulation for tests like this? I mean, it is it is my DNA if I'm sending this off to one of these companies. Do I have a right to understand what's in my own genome?
Well, that's a really interesting question. This issue of rights, because I think that, you know, if the companies, the direct-to-consumer genomic companies, have really taken a strong stand that consumers do have a right to their genetic information. But a more pressing question really is, what do they have a right to? So should consumers expect a certain level of validity in terms of the information that they are purchasing? And if so, who's going to make sure that this actually is the kind of information they're receiving? You know, one of the problems is that direct-to-consumer personal genetic testing falls kind of in a regulatory no man's land with little oversight by federal agencies. No agency is really staking claim over these types of products and services. And so at this point, it's really fallen through the cracks. And there have been some regulatory actions on the level of states. So last year, the states of California and New York issued cease and desist orders to a number of direct-to-consumer genomic companies. And really, that order came from this from the enforcement of a requirement that genetic tests be ordered by a licensed physician. I believe since then, most of the companies have gotten around this challenge by employing health professionals on their company staff. But it really does leave the basic question unanswered as to whether or not genetic information really does need a kind of gatekeeper, a professional, health professional, kind of mediating who has access and what type of information is then given to the consumer slash patient.
Okay, that makes sense. So some of these companies, and maybe you can describe, if there's more than one, 23andMe makes it into this discussion a good bit, because the company offers a social networking aspect. So in addition to telling me about my DNA, I can share it and compare it with other people. Can you talk about the service a little bit and
sure,
whether or not this is safe or useful?
Right. Well, you're right in that 23andMe is really kind of a front runner in this in terms of developing their own online social networking tools. And so if you, as a customer of 23andMe, go onto the website and you receive your results, you have the option of using some of their online tools to share information with others who are members of the 23andMe community, if you will. And so that may range from anyone from, you know, a relative, a friend, an acquaintance, who have you, to share information. And what they'll do for you is, depending on who you've decided to share information with, it could be one person, it could be a group of people, will give you kind of a visual map of your relative similarity or difference in terms of your susceptibility for the traits and conditions that you deem you want to share with others in terms of the information. And so they've really been kind of a leader, if you will, in the field in terms of developing these tools for their customers. Although there are other companies, I believe DecodeMe also has a more simplified tool on their website, as well as GeneTree, which offers ancestry testing information, I think, specifically. And they allow some social networking on their actual company websites. Another way that social networking may be emerging is collaborations between these companies with other networking platforms like Facebook, MySpace.com, Twitter, what have you, to allow customers to share information via their various pages that they have on these sites.
Are any of those projects underway? Can I share my DNA information through Facebook right now?
I believe they are underway. I don't know if the capability is yet up and running, but I do believe that there is various collaborations that are going on between Facebook and some of these DTC companies. Now, your second question, I think, is really quite important in terms of whether or not sharing genetic information is safe. The question is, you know, one is confidentiality, of course. So the idea that like anything we share online, we worry whether or not that information is going to fall into the hands of people that we actually don't want to have this information. And so, you know, those type of challenges are always there. But there is, I think, another area of concern in terms of customers not even being equipped to know which information they may or may not want to share with others. And so the idea that you may have a risk or a higher risk for a particular complex trait, let's say breast cancer, not only implicates you, but it actually has a lot of implication perhaps for your children or your children's children. And so one of the special qualities of genetic information is that it is information about the primary user, but it's also information about others who may not have consented or agreed to have that information shared with other individuals. And so you know, these concerns are ones that we want to address in terms of who has the right to consent to have information shared when they may have implications for a broader number of people. In terms of the regulation, we all know that last year the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was passed, which was a long and kind of arduous challenge, but after 10 years it was passed, and it does prevent many different areas of potential discrimination. However, it's not complete, and so it does not protect genetic discrimination in the context of life, disability, or long-term care insurance. But in addition to that, it's unclear how the law will treat access to genomic information that's available through these online services. So, for example, if someone puts information out there on one of these platforms to share with family, friends, or others, it is unclear whether or not GINA will actually extend to protect that information in the case that it falls into the hands of other organizations or employers or what have you through that mechanism. And so right now I know that the EEOC is taking comments on the legislation to see whether or not there might be a way of making much more clear what some of the regulatory protections are, but at this point it is rather ambiguous.
And that's the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's really interesting. You have information that people approach it on an individual basis, but it's inherently social because it's about you, but it's also about the people that you're related to. And at the same time, it seems like it's information that we don't completely understand what all of it means.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it may be that you would want to, after depending on where you are in your life stage, you may change your mind in terms of whether or not you want to share this information. But of course, once you've made that decision to put it out there, it's often very hard to kind of take it back. And so, I think one of the biggest challenges will be to ensure that customers understand what the broader implications might be for them and their families if they do decide to share information online.
Okay, so we've been talking about what this information can mean for individuals in maybe in a healthcare setting and for people that they want to share it with. What about the other side of this type of research? Part of what these companies are also doing is making some of this information available for researchers, for geneticists, for people in biomedical research to help make better sense of people's genomes. Can you talk about the ethics of doing that?
Sure. So what we're seeing is that some of these companies are doing exactly what you just described, that they are taking consumer-generated genetic information and building commercial databases. And, one of the potential uses of these databases could be that they decide to license it to other companies or organizations for example, clinical trials work.
Now, do people have a choice about this when they're using these services?
Right. So they do, at least the companies that I've looked at, they do require that individuals consent to have their information put into these databases. However, it's very hard to evaluate that type of consent process because at this point it is unclear as to what those future uses might be of the information. So, for example, we would often require researchers when they are administering informed consent to be rather explicit about what type of research questions might be asked of the data, for example, so that the person donating the sample or the information would have a clear understanding of what the future implications might be. At this point, it would be probably best to characterize the consent as kind of open consent, in that you are, in a sense, asking the company to be a custodian of your data, and that that you would agree to allow the company to engage in the type of collaborations that it wants to in terms of research questions. And so it's left so vague that we worry that whether informed consent can be really achieved when it's left to kind of just an open array of different future uses. So one of the central questions that really needs to be addressed, I think, is this boundary between consumer and research participant, because with these direct-to-consumer genomic companies and their products, that boundary is becoming increasingly blurred. So the question is whether or not consumers are in a position to provide informed consent without knowing how their data will be used and who will ultimately use it really does kind of make us think about this, I guess, tension that's growing. On the one hand, we I think, have been witnessing this paradigm shift in terms of consumers wanting access to their information and wanting to participate directly in biomedical research. We've seen this with the emergence of different patient advocacy campaigns. But on the other hand, we as a society also have a commitment to safeguarding the unknowing research participant from potential abuse. So really finessing this balance will be a central challenge as direct-to-consumer genomics expands.
I think that's really interesting what you're talking about, people wanting to be involved in research. And people are also wanting to get more involved, it seems, in the choices in their own healthcare. So part of what I am also interested in is, does access to this kind of direct-to-consumer genetic testing, is this something, because there is an expense associated with it, it can cost a few $100s, it can cost a few $1,000s, is this going to add to existing inequities in the healthcare system where some people can get this extra information and make decisions about their healthcare with it, whereas other people might not be able to afford it?
So that's a really, really important question. With any expensive technology, and this technology is very expensive still, there is a concern that the benefits will only be available to those who can afford it. We see this, that right now, at least, most of these products cost at least a couple $100s, and some, if you want to get into whole genome sequencing, tens of thousands of dollars. So clearly, the price points make it so that the vast majority of the public is not going to be able to access some of these services. Now, having said that, what we have also seen in the last several years is a precipitous decrease in price of in terms of the cost of sequencing. And so I think it's fair to say that we can expect, the $1,000 whole genome to be not so far in the future. And it may be that with decreasing costs, genetic sequencing will be ubiquitous so that everyone will be able to access that information. But, it may be that the biggest contributor to, this potential genomic divide will not be technical, but will be system related. And what I mean by that is that, having raw data means little unless you can actually interpret the data into clinically useful options. And so at this point, what we're seeing is that you have this explosion of data, and this is probably only going to get be a larger problem in the future, in the near future. But what hasn't kept pace is the education, the public education in terms of what genetic risk might mean, what does, just basic concepts in terms of probability, susceptibility, inheritance. These key concepts are not ones I think that the general public has a good handle on. And, are probably concepts that, in terms of medical education, we don't do a very good job of teaching to our physicians. And so one big issue, I think, is how some of this, so what we're seeing in terms of access to genomic data will be translated into useful clinical information. And that, I think, is what we might see a big divide in terms of who can actually use this information.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what the next steps in research on this type of testing are. Is that one area where you feel like people need to investigate further or develop better tools for teaching people in the medical practice how to help people look at this info?
Yeah, I think there are so many areas that we need further research in terms of direct-to-consumer genomics and just basic empirical work on how consumers are taking in this information, what their expectations are going in, but also how they're understanding the risk information that's provided to them and what actions it might prompt. So, you know, looking at consumer behavior will be important. Also, looking at how they're sharing this information will be really important. So who do they share with? How do they share this information in terms of the technology? Is it online? Is it in the doctor's office? Is it via these various social networking platforms? And then, you know, looking at kind of the research implications, you know, how do these individuals who do share their information, do they participate in terms of kind of grassroots efforts around biomedical research? Now, on the science side, there's a lot of research to be done, of course, and one area is just outcomes data. Presumably we will have an electric medical record system that might be a national system, and if that's the case, it may be much easier to try to track how patients use genetic risk information, but also just looking at kind of the interactions between genetics and environment will be very important, and hopefully with kind of more standardized systems of collecting medical information, we might be able to have a better understanding of what those interactions might be on different individuals.
Well, let me just ask you one question to sort of wrap things up. Is this mm-hmm. is this going to help people live healthier lives, this access to their own genetic information?
Well, that's a really hard question. I think, there is this hope, and I think what we're seeing, especially with this kind of shift among the public, among consumers to get this type of information, is the hope that we'll reap some type of we'll reap the rewards of our $1 million investment in trying to understand human genetics. I think that what it's going to take is a lot of kind of regulatory guidance and kind of a system overhaul in terms of equipping our healthcare system in terms of translating data into useful, clinically useful information for individuals, and that will be a difficult challenge. But I think there is a commitment to that.
Well, Sandra Lee at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this really important issue.
Thank you very much.